dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Today's program is going to be a singular example of the kind of threat assessment that you uniquely get here at Secure Freedom Radio. The briefing will be provided today for the full hour by one of the most accomplished national security policy practitioners I've had the privilege of knowing and working with over, well, the better part of 40 years. His name is Roger W. Robinson, Jr. He served with distinction in the Reagan administration on the National Security Council. We'll talk more about that in a moment. These days, he is the president as well as the founder of RWR Advisory Group. He is also the co-founder and chairman of a marvelous institution in Prague. It's called the Prague Security Studies Institute. And I couldn't be more pleased to have this time with him to describe for you both some of the predicate for what Roger Robinson is doing at the moment in terms of really important accomplishments in the national security arena in the past, and some incredibly timely and, I think, vital work that he is about at the moment. So Roger Robinson, my friend, my colleague of many years, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank.
Well, let's start a little bit with some background here, Roger. You began your professional career not in government, not in the national security space, but with a bank, a rather important bank, particularly in that era, the Chase Manhattan Bank. Tell us a little bit about your experiences there, what your duties were, who you worked for, and what you learned in the course of your work at Chase.
Well, Frank, the Chase Bank experience was eye-opening, to say the least. I had not been studying economics and accounting and the like, and I'll tell you, I had the ultimate crash course there. After the executive management training program, I had the good fortune of doing a stint for almost a year in Tokyo, but then returned to what was the USSR Eastern Europe division of Chase. Chase, in the detente days of the early 70s, was the first American bank to open in Moscow a representative office. And it was an era where there was obviously a move afoot to see if commercial bridge building could eventuate in closer geopolitical relationships. Obviously, that went wrong in an important way. And as always, the Soviets merely used these openings to acquire more technology financing and the means to expand their empire at our expense.
Roger Robinson, you have, of course, experience at Chase, not only working on the sort of detente project with lending to the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc and what was then known as Yugoslavia, but you also worked for its chairman as a special assistant for some time. Tell us about the insights, both from what you firsthand observed the bank being asked to do and what the Soviets were making of it, but also your interactions with and experiences in the company of David Rockefeller.
Well, it was a very special opportunity. David Rockefeller was the leading space business statesman of his time, right through his 100-plus years of life, and it was a privilege to have a chance to be with him on nearly a daily basis for 3 years, helping along the line the international piece of his activities. And it really did bring home how heads of state feel about bankers or unique business statesmen like David, in the sense that they saw him as a kind of permanent president, as opposed to those that cycle through every 4 years or every 8 years. It was a presence that a lot of heads of state counted on for continuity. And the Soviets were no exception. They saw there an open mind and a very trusting soul who was real looking to see if banking could be a force for good. And it was at the same time the most disciplined bank, in the sense that we never lent cash to Moscow, so-called balance of payments loans. They were always very disciplined and project or transaction oriented, with no time for the Soviets to spare in terms of free cash flow. So that was important from my point of view, and I think the bank was a leader there. Other banks couldn't get away with it because the Soviets wanted just cash that they could use at their discretion. And the other banks of the world, including Deutsche Bank and too many others to name, as well as my American counterparts, were all too happy to lend on an undisciplined basis. So these are some of the lessons that were gained from that experience.
And you found yourself observing in close quarters a particular transaction that the Russians were engaged in that had the potential to create not only very substantial, essentially undisciplined cash flow for them, but also geopolitical leverage on our European allies. Tell us about the Siberian gas pipeline and what you discovered about its financing.
Well, very briefly, we at Chase, along with many other banks in the West, pulled together four different consortiums, or syndicated loans, as they're called, of about $500, $600 million a pop to finance the Orenburg gas pipeline, a 1,700-mile pipeline from the Caucasus into the West European gas grid. So I was familiar with the gas pipeline business and the centerpiece role it was playing and certainly designed to play for the Soviet hard currency cash flow. Then and now, natural gas is one of their biggest earners. And along with oil is 66%, for example, of their total revenue stream. So that said, when the Siberian gas pipeline came along at more than twice the size and the a two-strand pipeline, not one, I quickly realized that the amount of gas going into the West European gas grid would make Western Europe at least 70-75+% dependent on Soviet gas. Look at all the problems we're having today with Nord Stream 2 at 35% dependent. You can imagine what that would look like at twice the amount. And it nearly doubled the hard currency income of the Soviets, which was only $32 billion at the time.
Roger, we have to take a break. Let's pause on that note, and we will come back and find out more about how this story unfolded. That and much more with Roger Robinson of RWR Advisory Group, as well as the Prague Security Studies Institute, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're visiting for this full hour with an extraordinary man of action, both in terms of economic warfare and national security more generally. His name is Roger W. Robinson, Jr. He has been a close friend and colleague of mine and one of the very important contributors to much of the work that we do at the Center for Security Policy for decades. And I'm grateful to him for his friendship as well as for his time today to talk about some extraordinarily important work he's engaged in at the moment. So, Roger, I want to get to that work, but just to sort of bring to closure, what the ultimate upshot of the work you did on the Siberian Gas Pipeline project proved to be, and we'll get into some of the lessons learned from it. Interestingly enough, my sister, known at the time as Devin Gaffney, was the editor of a very important piece you wrote about all of this in the Washington Quarterly, which came to the attention, as I recall, through an old boss of mine, Fred E. Clay, former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, and a man you had the privilege subsequently of working for, Judge William P. Clark, the president's second national security advisor during the Reagan years. Give us just a quick reprise of what that all involved and what it led to in terms of policy and really geostrategic decisive action at the highest levels of the United States government and the NATO alliance, for that matter.
Well, in April of 1981, I wrote co-wrote, in fact, a larger piece in the New York Times entitled Europe's Big Gamble on Soviet Gas. I think it was the front page of the business section of the Sunday New York Times. In any event, it had a map, and it really tried to take on the consequences of the Siberian gas pipeline, this two-strand, 3,600-mile revenue builder for Moscow and dependency builder for the West into come to fruition. And if it did, obviously, we would be looking at a situation where NATO countries were wildly, inordinately dependent on Soviet gas. And of course, the Soviet revenue stream, as I mentioned, would have been nearly doubled. So this was a counterintuitive at the time, because nobody was viewing pipelines, no matter how big and onerous, as national security worthy subjects. So this was a bit of a flyer for me, and certainly a risk, because I was still with Chase at the time, and just with a disclaimer on the bottom.
This was not the party line, needless to say.
It wasn't. And I went on. I had the good fortune, of course, to work with Devin and doing an expanded piece called Soviet Gas Risk or Reward for the Washington Quarterly, that apparently in draft came to the attention of the president himself through the Secretary of Defense and the National Security Advisor, as you referenced. And it was used as a centerpiece of the Ottawa Economic Summit of the G7 in the summer of 1981, where the president implored the West European allies not to go forward with this pipeline, particularly given the tensions in Poland and beyond, and that this was a wholly inappropriate and dangerous endeavor.
He found himself in this regard at cross purposes with, among others, his very dear friend and close ally, Margaret Thatcher. Did he not?
He did, because she had a company that she was trying to save via sales to Moscow called John Brown Engineering. And they were going to play a prominent role in the pipeline, and it was going to keep that company literally a going concern. So she was invested heavily there, as were other European allies, who were seeing more jobs and more exports in one deal than they had ever seen in East-West history. And the power of the money and the employment question were huge.
Right. Well, this is a point that we're going to come back to momentarily. But just to finish the story, what happened, you went into the Reagan administration, served as the Senior Director for International Economic Affairs on the NSC, working for Judge Clark. And you played, as I think has now been well established, a very, very important role behind the scenes in developing the Reagan strategy, not just with respect to this pipeline and what it meant as a threat to the alliance, to our interests, but as part of the larger strategy that President Reagan implemented, I think particularly of his National Security Decision Directive 75. I know there were others that you worked on as well, but that really were blueprints for taking down the evil empire. Give us, again, just a quick story there, if you would.
Well, there were only 12 or 13 people in the loop on the economic and financial portion, if you will, of the Soviet takedown strategy. It had as its components putting a strict limit on Soviet gas deliveries to Western Europe, killing the second strand of the Siberian gas pipeline, delaying the first strand with our technology and equipment being held back from it as long as possible. We did, in fact, affect a 2 to 3 year delay. Tightened technology controls, encouraged the Saudis to pump more oil to lower prices and decontrol prices at the wellhead, knocking down oil prices to $10 a barrel when for every dollar drop in the price of a barrel of oil, the Soviets were losing $500 million to $1 billion a pop. So to make a long story short, this was the essence of the economic and financial strategy I had the good fortune to be the architect of. And when we implemented, and we did, after a lot of blood on the floor and after denying four European companies, or possibly five, we closed the U.S. market to them because they continued to ship to the pipeline over our objection. So this became a very contentious alliance issue. But at the end, we got a 30% ceiling on Soviet gas deliveries to Western Europe, which enabled the Troll gas field in Norway to become competitive and take up that slack, which wouldn't have otherwise happened. We ended subsidized, if you can believe it, loan arrangements whereby Western taxpayers were giving the Soviets below market rates. And a number of these other inequities were resolved. And, of course, we savaged their hard currency cash flow and cutting off availability of credit, both government and private sector, which they were able to trundle along for 7 or so years, muddle through, and then ultimately went down. 2 days before the collapse of the Soviet Union, they defaulted on $96 billion in Western debt. So they went out of business the old-fashioned way.
Right. And I think it's fair to say they were put out of business, and you played a very significant role in achieving that, Roger, including, by the way, with the creative use by President Reagan, as I recall, of the International Emergency Economic Powers Act that we have been hearing a bit about lately in context of President Trump and China. And I want to pivot, Roger, to China, because you are these days very engaged, both through the work you're doing at RWR Advisory Group with your Intel Track database and in the public policy arena with the Prague Security Studies Institute, in raising awareness about what China is doing, specifically in ways that I think are best described as economic warfare, you know, unrestricted economic warfare at that, against the United States. So tell us just a little bit about what you have been doing professionally to monitor some of these activities and help the rest of us make sense of their strategic implications.
Well, Frank, once upon a time, it was looking at Soviet natural gas, if you will, infiltrating or penetrating the West European gas grid and creating these inordinate dependencies. Flash forward to today with China, it's not natural gas, it's capital, it's old-fashioned dollars. And they have moved into our debt and equity markets, the so-called capital markets of the United States, with about 700 of their companies, hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars of exposure, possibly a trillion or more, is already been booked, so to speak. Chinese companies are, a number of them are bad actors from a national security and human rights perspective. The broader point is that this too creates a dependency. So the Chinese are trying to, of course, raise dollars, which they urgently need, out of the United States. And when their companies go IP, initial public offerings of stock, or the sale of stock, the sale of bonds, they are, of course, attracting hundreds of billions of dollars of American investor money, creating a lobby that makes today's business lobby appear trivial, with scores of millions of Americans who would have, if this is allowed to fester and go forward, a financial vested interest in seeing no penalties or sanctions of any kind against China, almost irrespective of the offense, for reasons that it would damage the value of their investment portfolios and retirement accounts. Beijing is all too aware of this gambit, so they get a twofer. They get the money, which they critically need, and they get the China lobby of their dreams. And again, these are not just Chinese companies that are benign commercial.
Roger, that's the point at which I want to just take a quick break. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about some of these firms that are now getting money from us out of our capital markets and for purposes that will shock you. We'll discuss that and much more with Roger W. Robinson with our continuing conversation about unrestricted economic warfare now being waged against this country by communist China. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Roger Robinson is our guest for this full hour. He has been working assiduously. We've been discussing the various ways on trying to protect our country against existential threats to freedom, as his former boss and mine, Ronald Reagan, used to say, now for several decades and with great effect, particularly in his efforts to combat the previous generation's threat from the Soviet Union. And today, the work that he is doing is no less important, I believe, with respect to communist China, our time's existential threat to freedom. And Roger, you were telling us about how China is getting into our capital markets, apparently for two reasons. One, to most obviously garner funding for some of their companies, but secondly, also in the process to recruit large numbers of American investors, whether it's institutional investors, pension funds, or individuals, as a new, vastly larger and very influential China lobby. And you titillated us a little bit there in the last segment about some of the companies that these investors are actually underwriting. Tell us some examples and what they are doing that is materially harmful to our country and the material risk involved in helping pay for their activities.
Well, there's all manner of national security and human rights abusers in our markets. And in terms of the national security side, I'm thinking about sanctions violators, proliferators, South China Sea island builders, North Korea underwriters, known hackers, advanced weapons manufacturers for the PLA.
Including things like aircraft carriers and submarines, as I understand it, that are being built for one purpose, let's be clear, and that is ultimately to wage war against the United States.
Yes, welcome to the world of China shipbuilding, which is in our markets in a significant way, and is starting to have the bright idea to pay for its next aircraft carrier by floating a dollar-denominated bond in the Frankfurt Exchange and selling off about 25 or 30% of that billion-dollar offering to Americans. That in effect, results in American investors helping finance the next nuclear aircraft carrier that China's building at first, and not to mention other of the products, if you will, weapon systems of China shipbuilding that include submarine-launched ballistic missile, and those, including those that carry ICBMs targeting our city. So it puts the American people in the business right there of financing the kind of conventional and even nuclear threats that most folks would be appalled to learn is being underwritten with their retirement dollars.
One would certainly hope that Americans would be appalled by this, but they're unlikely to find out about it unless they take advantage of a product that you have available at RWR Advisory Group. Tell us about Intel Track and the lack of transparency with respect to the obvious material risk that your investment may be going into this kind of activity that is so detrimental to, inimical really, to our national security interests here in the United States.
Well, our IntelTrack product, Frank, is one that tracks and visually maps every Chinese and Russian transactions globally on a daily basis with data going back 7 years now. That's not exactly the list in terms of bad actors that are coming to are already in our capital markets. We do have such a list, however, that's been generated with the help of IntelTrack. We do a kind of risk assessment of Chinese companies that provides a background on the types of national security and human rights wrongdoing that we're discussing now, a kind of rap sheet, if you will, on a company-by-company basis. So these are things that we have. It's been a function of a lot of grinding research, so to speak, but we're now in a position where we can not only understand the nature of the Chinese companies in the U.S. capital markets, but which institutions are holding them, which state public pension systems, which university endowments, which even the federal thrift savings plan, which we'll talk about a bit later, perhaps, is in the mix here. And too many other portfolios to name, you know, exchange-traded funds, mutual funds.
And the MSCI, as it's called, is a prime focus of effort. Is that right?
Indeed. I mean, these large index providers are the greatest thing that China's ever found in terms of attracting capital. They get their companies on the list or on the inclusion into these indexes. And once they do, they are automatically purchased by trillions of dollars, in some cases, of funds under management, because people are passively invested. They're not picking and choosing stocks. Whatever the index buys, they automatically are in.
Yeah. I want to drill down on this for a moment. First of all, tell us how people can find out the kind of information you're talking about, IntelTrack and this other list with this important data in it.
At rwradvisory.com is our website. And we can, although there's nothing about the cap markets list on the website right now, that's the kind of thing that we'd be pleased to talk with people.
Get in touch through rwradvisory.com. Roger, the one other piece of this, and you've made several presentations for which I'm very grateful at the Committee on the Present Danger China threat briefings, and they are available online in video form at presentdangerchina.org. I'm thinking in particular of your most recent one on the 18th of July, and I really encourage our listeners to check it out. It's just 10 minutes or so, but extremely powerful. And one of the key points you made there is that, just as you say, people putting their pension funds, let's say, or other investments into something like the Morgan Stanley MSCI Index are passively investing. You made the observation that neither the MSCI nor the companies involved, these Chinese conglomerates or other nefarious entities, are making the kinds of disclosures of material risk that enables a degree of transparency and accountability that is required of American companies. How could that possibly be, Roger? And to what extent might it contribute to this very dangerous trend that you've described of investors becoming underwriters of our enemies and perhaps enlisted unwittingly, unintentionally into the China lobby to boot?
It's important to note that there has never been in the history of our country a security-minded screening mechanism that helps cover our capital markets. So we don't have any federal entity that is systematically looking for national security or human rights abusers, not just because of the material risk that you're discussing, but the broader problem of our underwriting perilous activities around the world that are inimical to U.S. security interests and our moral compass when it comes to unwittingly funding surveillance equipment for concentration camps in Xinjiang, like those that equipment provided by Hikvision, who happens to have a prominent place in our markets and a prominent place in the MSCI Emerging Market Index, as well as its All-Country World Index, and I'm sure other indexes, including them as well, which means that trillions of dollars of funds under management, as they're called, are investing in these kinds of outrageous human rights related abuses and the indirect participation of these companies in those abuses. So that's for starts as far as disclosure.
And just take a minute there, Roger, though. Hikvision is doing exactly what in terms of helping build up this security state apparatus for China?
It's part of the police state digitization, so to speak, of the country, whereby they have elaborate security and surveillance networks now, including facial recognition technology, including security, if you will, surveillance cameras that are every few meters along the top of the walls of concentration camps holding well over a million Uyghurs, Muslim minorities, in Xinjiang region, and are using that same equipment to pick up dissident Tibetans at train stations and to track all manner of what they consider undesirables and dissidents.
Well, really monitoring the entire population, and in a way, worse yet, now available for export to authoritarian or totalitarian regimes elsewhere around the world. Really a tremendously dangerous ramping up of, as I say, this sort of police state capability.
We found that Hikvision surveillance cameras were being used by one of our most prominent Air Force bases.
Yeah, that's right. Here in the United States, no less. Yeah.
I mean, it's one thing to monitor every block of a city, which Beijing is keen to do because all that data is flowing back into China. But when you get down to military bases and the like, the espionage possibilities boggle the mind.
Yeah, our bases. Raj, we have to pause. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about disclosure, that and so much more right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back for the fourth and final installment of this incredibly interesting and I think very, very troubling conversation with Roger W. Robinson, who has been working on protecting our country as the oath he swore, as did I, many years ago, obliges him to do against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And this work has brought him to the forefront of an effort to try to ensure that there is disclosure of material risks in our capital markets and ideally, a closing of the door to them for Chinese People's Liberation Army and Communist Party associated enterprises that are now gaining access to stock indexes and to the capital markets more generally. We're going to talk in a moment about one particularly alarming new potential area of penetration. But Roger, just close out on this issue of disclosure. I mentioned earlier that there are different rules for American companies than for Chinese companies when it comes to being transparent about material risk. How could that possibly be?
Well, it's very odd indeed. I mean, the mandate of the Securities and Exchange Commission since, I think, 1933 has always been, in part, that it's important that all material risks – that accompany an investment be made, again, not just made transparent, but be listed in the risk section of prospectuses and other SEC filings so that the prospective investor can make a more informed decision about where their money's going and how it's being used. This is not happening adequately, remotely adequately, in the case of Chinese companies when it comes to national security and human rights abuses of the past. You don't see South China Sea island builders and those militarizing those islands. China doesn't view it as a risk. And our investment banks and others that bring them to market are willing to live with the Chinese interpretation of that not being a risk because, after all, it's their exclusive territory and a sovereign territory, I should say. So these are the kind of problems we get into, and you don't see that somebody is an advanced weapons manufacturer who's a serial violator of U.S. sanctions for proliferation concerns, for example. I mean, these are all and not to mention Hikvision and the human rights side of that equation, all of these are obviously material risks that could cause major damage to not only share value, but corporate reputation. And yet they walk, even though it's legally actionable in the United States for what's called material omissions. There hasn't been a class action lawsuit brought against the Chinese. Not one company has ever been delisted for national security and human rights reasons. I mean, and the list goes on. So they have gotten a free pass that just doesn't quit.
Right. And Roger, the thing that's so alarming to me about this is not simply that we are acting against interest. We are helping, as I say, and I use the term advisedly, our enemies in communist China become more formidable in terms of the capacity to harm us. That's bad enough. But I think knowing them as we do, knowing, well, any totalitarian, really, any bully, to take it right down to the, you know, most basic level, is emboldened when they see people behaving like this in a sort of craven way. It only makes that danger, the likelihood that those threatening capabilities will actually be used, whether it's unrestricted economic warfare in the first instance or perhaps kinetic military capabilities down the road. It's very ominous indeed. And that's true in spades of something that you tumbled upon recently. And with the help of Senators Marco Rubio and Jeanne Shaheen, have now begun raising a serious alarm about. Tell us about this so-called thrift savings plan and what is now in the offing if we don't get our hands around it.
Well, Frank, the federal employees' retirement system, which in effect this is a $578 billion fund covering 5.7, I believe, million American federal employees and members of our armed forces, who are basically now subject to a change taking place due to a decision at the end of 2017 by the, I think it's called the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board. It's kind of a mouthful, but I call it just the Thrift Savings Board. And they decided in their wisdom that they were going to switch out of a safe developed country index or list of countries that they're prepared to buy, which we've had, you know, since time immemorial, best I know, to the MSCI All Country World Index to expand to emerging markets and countries, as they say, all over the world. Well, guess what? Some 8% or more of all of those companies are Chinese. And then when you look at the roster of who they are, you find, again, the Hikvisions, the Avix, which is a PLA weapons manufacturer. You find China Mobile that's been barred from the United States from national security reasons, and the list goes on. So this is now going to be the index that, in effect, governs all international equity exposure. which is about $50 billion. So if you want, let's say you want some international stocks in your portfolio for diversification purposes, which is pretty sensible, now it's all provided by the MSCI All World if this decision is allowed to be implemented in 2020. So it is a reckless, frankly, wrongheaded decision. I think Senator Rubio and Senator Shaheen are doing yeoman's work in pointing to this in excruciating detail as to what the consequences are going to be here. The Financial Times covered it in a prominent way on February 26th, and as did Nikkei and Bloomberg and others. August, my apologies. And so it's something happening, Frank, right now.
Yeah. Real time, playing out as we speak. Okay. So, Roger, to just stitch this all together in the remaining couple of minutes we have, knowing what you do from the experience that President Reagan, whom you served so ably, accomplished in countering a totalitarian threat to this country in the form of the Soviet Union, what specifically are you recommending to senators like Marco Rubio and Jean Shaheen and others, to the president himself, be done at this moment to try to deal with today's totalitarian communist existential threat to freedom from communist China?
The most immediate, Frank, is, of course, the reversal of this thrift savings plan decision. That's number one, and because that's coming right up on us now. But more generally, as you talked about this, the disclosure requirements, they need to be mandatory. We need to close these gaps, for goodness sake. National security and human rights violations are not regarded as material risks by the markets today. I don't think that they're regarded as material risks by the SEC today. That's why these huge loopholes are created that the Chinese pour through, literally pour through. So the point is, that's got to be closed up. There needs to be the kind of disclosure that Beijing is not interested in partaking in. And they not only mention, I mean, not to mention the fact that there needs to be equitable treatment. I mean, for example, Senator Rubio has the Equitable Act. These are very important pieces of legislation because they point to the very preferential treatment that Beijing is receiving today, for example, in accounting firms and certifications, that they are not complying with what their American counterparts are required to do. So if we just follow the existing rules, if we don't need something that draconian, I think that we have a very achievable set of circumstances here that make national security and human rights genuine material risk factors. We're going to scrutinize Chinese companies coming to our market. They are our principal adversary for the 21st century. We can't continue to dance around that.
Roger, thank you for your time today. We are unfortunately out of time. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.